أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، ولا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله العلي العظيم. ثم الصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين وخاتم النبيين محمد وآله الطاهرين. My respected elders, brothers and sisters, Salaamun Alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Alhamdulillah for this opportunity to be here. I would like to thank the organizers of this program for inviting me to participate and inshallah be part of the mission of spreading the word of Imam Hussein alayhi salam and the mission and message of the Ahlul Bayt. I want to thank the speakers before me for their enlightening comments, as well as the poetry, and as well as the those who are hosting the program and speaking. The topic that I was given to speak about is goals of the month of Muharram, and of course it's for the audience of Dhakirin and Dhakirat. So in terms of what I'm going to be speaking about, if you can go to the... I can do it myself here. Let's see. It doesn't seem to be working. Okay, great. So the overview of what I'll be doing is, first of all, mentioning some of the goals of the month of Muharram, because that's a topic. And then because it's for the people who are attending are those who are spreading the message of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, I want to offer some tips as to how we can be part of achieving those goals, meaning that as people who are speaking to audiences and conveying the message, how can we be part of that process of conveying those goals and helping people to achieve them. And just as a disclaimer, the sources for what I'll be explaining today are, of course, the words of my teachers, the speeches, and the writings of the ulama. So let's see, is this working? Okay, let me try. Let's see. Okay. Can you go back one? Okay. So what are some goals of the month of Muharram? I just would like to summarize some of the goals that the ulama have mentioned for us as to the purpose and the greatness of this month. First of all, keeping the message of Imam Hussein alayhi salam alive. This is a responsibility that we all have, to make sure that his message, his cause, the cause of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, is something that is preserved and carried on generation after generation. The second goal is becoming closer to the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. We're living at a time when people, because of the influence of Western society, Muslims, Shias, we find that, especially among the younger generation, people are finding substitutes to the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. They are moving in a direction, in some cases, which is away from the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. If you ask somebody, who are you, what are you, what is your identity? Some people would, without hesitation, say that they are Canadian. Okay, so you're Canadian. Okay, that's great. I'm not saying that we're not Canadian. We're Canadian, let's say. Okay, you're Canadian. What else are you? Well, I'm Canadian, and I'm, for example, from Pakistan, and I'm a member of the Liberal Party, right? And, oh yeah, I'm a Muslim as well, too. And then, yeah, I'm a Shia as well, too. It's kind of like somewhere down the line of identity labels. Whereas what Islam teaches us is that, first and foremost, we're Muslim. And our identity is Islam. And the people that we take as our role models are the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. So one of the best ways of reminding us of this very important point and of spreading this message is by talking about is the month of Muharram and the vehicle that the majalis give us. The majalis are one of the best forms of tawassul to the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam as well too. And one of the best forms of ibadah as well too. You all know the famous hadith from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, nafas al-mahmumi lana al-mughtammi bi-dhulmina tasbihun. The sigh of the one who is distressed on account of us, The one who is grieved because of the dhulm that was done for us is a tasbih, is an act of glorification of Allah. And the one who accordingly is saddened by the one who occupies him or herself with pursuing the cause of the Ahlul Bayt, that is an act of ibadah. So the month of Muharram is supposed to be a means of getting closer not only to the Ahlul Bayt, but also to Allah, of course, because that is the message of the Ahlul Bayt, to move towards Allah, to get qurb towards Allah, and also to the Qur'an as well too. Sometimes we find that the Qur'an is absent from our discussions, they're absent from our commemorations. The Qur'an isn't mentioned that much in our speeches or in our dhikr musibat, whereas the Ahlul Bayt are intertwined with the Qur'an. And so the experience of the month of Muharram is supposed to bring us closer to the Qur'an as well. Another goal that the ulama have mentioned is building emotional energy, and this was mentioned in the previous speeches as well too. We need that emotional energy that leads us to practice. In one of the writings of Sayyid Khamenei, he mentions a very beautiful example. He says that we human beings are like an automobile. An automobile which is functioned and equipped with a lot of features. We can do a lot of things. And we have, just like an automobile that's riding on the road, it has a lot of signs that guide it as to which way it can go and which way it ought to go. Similarly, we also have signs that guide us. We have guidance in the form of the deen. We have guidance in the form of ahkam, akhlaq, aqaid, all the teachings that we know about and that we learn about. But there's one thing an automobile needs without which it's not going to go forward. Even though it has all those features, even though it has those signs, it needs its fuel. Without fuel, it's not going to go anywhere. Similarly, we human beings need that fuel. And much of that emotional drive that gives us that inspiration to move forward comes from the remembrance of the Ahlul Bayt and from the occasions that we commemorate in the month of Muharram. Next slide, please. Okay, another example is taking practical lessons for life. So this is another goal that we have for the month of Muharram, is to take practical lessons for life. We have to see the tragedy of Karbala as a book of lessons for us. Lessons in various aspects of our lives. One of the lessons I've given here, that when we look at the tragedy of Karbala, we see a very distinct difference between right and wrong, between truth and falsehood. And we talk about this, right? We talk about how Imam Hussein stood for truth, and then Yazid stood for batil, and we describe the tragedy. But there's an important lesson that we can get from that, which is that there is truth, right? And there is the truth. Okay, it's not like the way that sometimes people are exposed to the world these days is that truth is how I define it. Whatever I feel to be right, that's what's right. And there is no absolute truth. Therefore, if I want to believe in something and you want to believe in something else, both of us can believe in that and we can both be right as well too, because there is no absolute truth. So when I look at Karbala, I see that actually there is a truth, there is the truth, and that truth is the truth of the Ahlul Bayt and Islam. It's the truth of the Qur'an. Now this is a very practical lesson that we can take from that, and we can talk about it as well too. We can mention that, okay, these types of things that you understand, you hear about, they sort of fall away when you realize that there is a source of truth and absolute truth. That's one example. Inshallah, as we go along, I'll be talking about some of the other practical lessons that we can take. Another goal is linking the past to the present and the future. Muharram is not just about recounting a tragedy of the past, as has been mentioned. It's about trying to find a way to bring that into the current and also to link it to the future as well too. And this is something that unfortunately we sometimes lack. I know myself growing up, many times the speeches I would hear would be things that would transport me to the past, and I would just sort of stay in the past. And then it was like, okay, the majlis is done, now I get back to the reality. Whereas that's not the way it should be. It should be the case that we see Karbala and we see the events there as being relevant to the current times. We should be talking about the Yazids of the time. We should be talking about the Imam Husseins of the time and those who support the message of Imam Hussein. And we should be creating hope in the coming of the Imam as well too. Imagine if somebody were to walk in, who had never been to a majlis before, they were to walk into a majlis, okay, and they don't know what's going on, a typical majlis. And let's say it's a very traditional type of majlis where the zakir or the zakira is just talking about what happened in the past. Well, if they look at that from the beginning to the end, it's just about events in the past. They'll see that the story builds up and it builds up, and then it ends, and it's very sad. And then everyone, that's how it ends. Everyone's done then. Now, the impression they will get is that, oh my God, this is terrible, right? What a tragedy. Whereas, that's not, and if that's the only thing that happens every time, then the impression will be that, well, you know, what's the point of living anymore? If that's how dark the world is, if people could do that type of thing, then might as well just, you know, call it quits. Let's just throw in our hats and just, you know, just bury ourselves in the ground. We're done with this world, man. I'm fed up with it. It's like that Sufi, after he had heard what took place in Karbala, he was busied off in his own world when whatever happened. And then later on, he got news of what happened. And he was so distraught by what took place that he stopped talking. He said, I'm not going to talk anymore to anybody. That's it. Okay, so should we do the same thing, that we just stop talking now because of what happened? Actually, the events that took place and then our commemoration of it, the way that we message it, of course we do cry, of course we talk about the dhulm, but within it there should be a glimmer of hope. And that hope is in the coming of the Imam. Right? This is supposed to be a continuum, it's supposed to be part of a process that leads to the beauty of the coming of the Imam of our time. Okay, next slide please. Now, that summarizes some of the main goals that based on the teachings of the ulama that we need to try to convey in our different ways that we do so, whether it be speeches, whether it be poetry, whether it be zikr musibat. Now what I'd like to do is offer some practical tips on how this can actually be done. So this part of the seminar is inshallah something which is practical. Okay, one up please. Okay, next slide. Yeah. Okay, so the first practical tip is to be inviting and not to be divisive. This is something that our ulama put a lot of emphasis on. Because of the emotions that are aroused as part of the commemorating the tragedy, sometimes we can develop this sort of desire to, you know, outdo the other. And we start to look for the enemy today around us, and we say that, oh, the enemy is the one who sides with a certain type of ideology. And you know how it goes, then we start making references to certain individuals, we start insulting people, and that sort of thing. Now, when we look at what the ulama tell us, they say that when we speak about sectarian issues that ignite the flames of sectarianism, we're basically taking a sword that's handed to us by the enemies of Islam, and we're wielding it ourselves. Now, we're basically being used as a tool for the enemies of Islam. Now, this is not acceptable. It's clear as day, it's clear as the sun in a bright day, that this is something that we cannot be supporting. We have to be very careful about this. What I would like to invite those of you who are speakers to do, if you're speaking in a place, for example, for, let's say, a series or multiple times, that you state in your first speech that I do not intend to be controversial, and I welcome anybody to attend, even if they are not those who subscribe to the school of the Ahlul Bayt, and then commit to presenting the material in a way that would not be offensive to somebody. That doesn't mean that we have to hide reality. That doesn't mean that we need to skirt over things and just say that, you know, these things aren't important, we don't need to talk about these. No, we do need to talk about important events that took place, but everything with its own way and its own sort of messaging, and keeping in mind the larger goal that we're trying to accomplish. Next slide, please. Okay, another practical tip is to present a multifaceted picture of what took place. The tragedy of Karbala is not just an emotional tragedy. Okay, that's one way that we can interpret it. We can look at it from the glasses of an emotional person. Okay, and I can see that, oh my God, it's such a tragic thing. And we can look at it just and limit it just to that, but that would be doing it an injustice. Sometimes, you know, we refer to that type of approach as a soap opera approach. Okay, so in soap operas, why do you watch them? Because they play on your emotions. And so as the more they play on your emotions, the more successful they are. But what took place was a real event, and it had multiple dimensions to it. One of the dimensions was an emotional dimension, but that wasn't just it. We need to look at the holistic picture and see what went on in a holistic sort of way. In that respect, for example, let me give you an example of that. Sometimes we look at the personality of Imam As-Sajjad alayhi salam, and we say that Imam Zainal Abidin Well, he plays that role of the bimar. He plays the role of the sick person in that tragedy that took place. And if you think about it, if you write a play and you wanted to like have a character who played the sick character, then yeah, you might have such a character and you have somebody and that's that person. But we have to keep in mind that Imam Sajjad alayhi salam was an imam. Right? He was a ma'asum. He was perfection. He had all perfection with him. He was the wali of Allah. He was the hujjah of Allah after the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salam on the earth. So to reduce Imam Sajjad to the bimar of Karbala and to say that's only the only thing he is, that would be doing an injustice to who he is. Similarly with the rest of what took place. This wasn't just a matter of innocent women and children, women and women being imprisoned, women's their veils being taken, children being killed. It was something much more than that. Another mistake that's made is to look at Karbala and to talk about it from the perspective of individuals like Mahatma Gandhi. They say that, oh, you know, they quote that one line from him that he was an inspiration for me. Or they quote, I don't know, these are different figures, right? And sometimes we hand out brochures and we say, okay, this is what the message of Karbala is. That's good if you want to talk to non-Muslims, you want to kind of draw them in. But we don't need to look at what they understood of Karbala to make our understanding of Karbala. Our understanding of Karbala is something much deeper than what they understood, because if they understood it, they would have gone further than they did. They would have become Muslim at least. They would have followed Imam Hussein in all ways. Okay, next slide. Now, what do I mean by this in a little bit more detail, especially the first point about not reducing it to a drama? As we talked about, one of the goals is to take practical lessons from what took place. Now, what does that mean? So, for example, within what took place, we see practical lessons of life. We see how a family should interact with each other. Okay, now that's something that you can point out as you're talking about different things that take place. As Imam Hussein is going to see Al-Hur ibn Yazid al-Ju'afi, the comments that he makes, you can look that up in the Maqtal and see what sort of things can you learn from that. You look at the dialogue that takes place between Imam Hussein and Ali Akbar alayhi salam. What can you take about that? What can you take from that regarding family interaction? You look at the interaction between a brother and a sister. What sort of lessons can we take about how a family should interact? We see so many examples of family interaction, child raising, etiquette of how we should be organized about things. You see how the army of Imam Hussein alayhi salam was very organized and everything was in place despite them knowing that they were going to meet a sure defeat. Right? These are lessons for us. In the line of the ziyarah of Ashura where we say Salmun liman salamakum wa harbun liman harabakum, that speaks volumes as to the philosophy of friendship in Islam. That again is a practical takeaway that we get from Karbala. Whatever angle we look at it, whatever we're looking for, we can find it. It's been said we can find it within what took place. Practical lessons of life. Practical lessons of subservience as well too. Imam Khomeini mentions this. He says that we see that Imam Hussein alayhi salam, you know, in the heat of battle, when somebody reminds him that, okay, the adhan, it's time for the adhan, the zuhr time has arrived, he praises him and he says that, may Allah place you among the musallin, those who do salah. Imam Khomeini mentions there that Imam Hussein alayhi salam wasn't battling just for the sake of battle. He was battling in order to establish prayer. Now, as part of talking about this particular event, okay, we can make a segue and discuss the importance of prayer. This is a practical lesson that we're taking from Karbala. The lesson of avoiding the haram. Okay, you know the stories about, you know, your bellies are filled with haram. Sometimes these speeches of Imam Hussein, not sometimes, all the time, every time, every speech of the Ahlul Bayt along the way and in Karbala, they're filled with, you know, just volumes of wisdom for us to take. As zakirin, as zakirat, our responsibility is to convey the teachings of these speeches as well too. Okay, yeah, they don't have that emotional value. They're not something that necessarily is going to cause tears to flow. But we have enough of that as well too. This is part of talking about Karbala, talking about what happened, is referring to the speeches and seeing what they said as well too. And just recently there was the book, the letters of Imam Hussein alayhi salam that he and the letters and the sayings of Imam Hussein along the way to Karbala, that was just translated into English and it was just published this year. It's also available in Farsi and I believe in Urdu as well too. the lesson of not being attached to the dunya, so many examples of that. If you just look at, for example, the speech of Umar ibn Sa'd, I believe, yes, the speech of Ibn, yeah, the poetry that he composes about whether he should take the governorship of Ray. You know how he was promised the governorship of Ray? And he says, should I take that or should I, you know, I know this is wrong, but then he says, okay, no, I'll go ahead and take, you know, I'll go for that, and even though it means that I might have to face punishment in the hereafter. So there's a lot that we can learn from that, and even those companions who didn't participate in Karbala, why did they stay back? The lesson of reading Quran, if you go and look at the biography of the important martyrs, of people like Musnad ibn Osaja, of people like Habib ibn Muzahir, one thing you see consistently is that they were people who had memorized the Quran. Now, as part of when you're talking about the tragedy, you can talk a little bit about the biography of these individuals. I mentioned, oh, by the way, you know, this is who they were, and they read Quran, and you know, that's something that we can take as well too. You can draw that practical lesson from their lives as well. And one of the very good books that has been written, which talks about each companion in detail, it's a Farsi book by Agha Tehrani. It was just published 2-3 years ago. Something Shaydan, it has the word Shaydan, I think, in it in Farsi. If you want the title later on, inshallah, I can give it to you. Okay, lessons of Tawheed. If you want to take it even deeper, lessons about Tawheed that we take from what took place. Dealing with trials. People face difficulties. People go, as part of living in this world, we face challenges, we face difficulties. How do we deal with them? Well, we can see how to deal with them in Karbala. As you see, for example, how Imam Hussein, his speech after his young infant son is martyred, and he said that this is something that I can bear because it is in the eyes of Allah. Right? That there becomes a key philosophy of how to deal with bala and affliction in life that we can derive from Karbala. And even deeper points like seeking the pleasure of Allah and how to lead a life seeking the pleasure of Allah as well too, this can be taken. Okay. Presenting a correct picture is another practical tip that I'd like to offer. This was mentioned in the previous speech as well too. I don't want to belabor the point, but I would just make this observation that sometimes people question, they say that if we don't mention those masaib that, you know, that we can't find the sources for, but that people really want to hear, then people aren't going to like what we have to say. So what do we do? Well, first of all, we have to see, what are we trying to do? Are we trying to please the people, or are we trying to please Allah? Okay, we're trying to please Allah. So what people have to say or they don't say, that's not really our major concern. Secondly, if you want to bring tears to people's eyes, which is actually a good thing and a beneficial thing, then let's not limit ourselves just to see how we can make the most dramatic and gory and detailed scene possible. Right? That, if you think about it, is a low-level approach, an inferior approach to trying to get people to cry. What do I mean by that? Okay, there's a superior approach. What is a superior approach? The superior approach is to bring the bigger picture to light. What is the bigger picture? Okay, here we have an imam, right? The hujjah of Allah on the earth at his time. The person who represents all of beauty, and you have somebody who is standing up against him and trying to kill him. Now, isn't that itself, when you start to talk about it in that light, isn't that itself something that is tragic? Right, here you have an infant, right, who has, you know, no sins, right, who has done nothing wrong, and yet you find that people are willing to slaughter him, right? Another example, they say that, okay, during the time of the revolution in Iran, what would happen is that they would always get news that you know, so-and-so has been martyred. And many times these were young individuals, young men, even sometimes children as well too. So news would come, and it would eventually find its way to the city from which that martyr, where he used to live basically. Now, the way that they would convey the news to the mother of the shaheed is that they would send a group of ladies to visit her, and together they would break the news to her in the hopes that that would be a means of consolation for her. So, you see here that they would do that, right? They would convey this in a group setting in order to make it easier for her to bear, right? Now, if you just say that and then you compare and contrast, you say, okay, well, what about Karbala? Who was there to console Sayyidah Zainab, you know, when she had to face what she had to face, right? You don't need to talk about the details of the gory details of the battle, or this thing happened, or this magical thing happened, you know, that doesn't have any source, right? That itself, if you just give the right type of imagery and try to help people understand, you know, the enormity of this tragedy that she's facing alone, right? That itself is enough to bring those tears to the people's eyes. Okay, now, what I would like to mention, though, is that sometimes what happens is that people refer to other speeches, and they say that, okay, because so-and-so said it, therefore I can use it in my speech as well, too. He mentioned this story, therefore I can mention this story. If you think about it, that's not a very accurate way of going about things, about just looking at what somebody said. Right? At the end of the day, we have a responsibility to convey what really happened, and so we need to try to find the sources. Now, if we are familiar with the sources, and we find that there is an alim who is using the sources and doing musibat based on that, then we can refer to that alim. But otherwise, or if somebody tells us, you know, this person is definitely credible, they've done research in this area, they know what they're talking about, they can distinguish between what's right and what's wrong, then we can use that. But otherwise, we should be trying to look for the sources themselves as well. I wanted to mention that there's a whole science around maqtal shanasi, like which maqtals are correct, which ones are not, which stories are correct, which details of which stories are correct, which ones are not. And this is something that is actually taught in the Hawza. And it's very good if those of you who are involved in this sort of thing, that you should try to learn something about the history of the maqatil, which one is more correct, which one's not, and how to go about reading them as well too. Another practical tip is using this opportunity to educate. Sometimes you have people who come to these gatherings that don't come to anything else. This is the only time, the only exposure they really have to a teaching platform in the whole year. And to not use that would be a shame. I give you the example of the car, and I said that there's these guideposts that are guiding it where to go. But for many people, they don't even have those guideposts. It's just this one time, one fuel stop, and that's pretty much it for the whole year. So it's good if we can take advantage of that. What does that mean? Some examples. Including in our bayan, sometimes talking about something that appeals to the intellect. Why? Because we're living in a generation, with a new generation now, where the young people have been trained to think about things and to critically reflect on things. Now, sometimes, I'm not saying that everything about that is necessarily good, like sometimes this type of thinking is shaitanic in nature, but at the end of the day, there is something that we have, which is the aql, and this is the age of the aql, at least kind of, meaning that we have to understand that the people in the audience are thinking people. And if we don't offer any food for thought, then we're not going to find people are benefiting the way they ought to. Talking about some important points, for example, we're going to talk about Imam Hussein, well, why do we even need an imam? Mentioning even one or two simple points itself will be very useful. Or for example, why cry? You know, why is it that we're crying so much? We need to talk about and answer this question, not just take it for granted that, oh, because everyone cries in Muharram, therefore everyone's going to cry, and we should just do it just like that. You'll be surprised if you talk to the young people how many questions they have around these type of issues, like why should I even cry? Or those who have been influenced with some of the Wahhabi sort of thinking, they say that, okay, well, no, the Prophet forbade people to cry over those who are dead, so why is it you Shias cry so much? And they stop attending majalis because of these shubahat, these misconceptions that they have. Now, we have answers to all of these things. Everything that we do, alhamdulillah, the principles of what we do are grounded, but we need to educate people about these. Using the opportunity to talk about ahkam as well, to mention even one law, just one, okay, but it's very important that we pick the law very carefully, meaning not just some random hukum that sometimes you bring something that will actually turn off people, right, or something that has no relevancy whatsoever. Or you talk about something, we might talk about something that isn't meant for the common people, it's meant for those who are at a higher level and they want to exercise ihtiyat or something like that. Something that's relevant and something that's explained properly as well too. That we've heard the way that an alim explains this particular hukum. It's very important because it's not just a matter of reading it, but also explaining it as well too. Our teachers tell us that when you get something from the sources, from an alim, it's an example of a baby who for whom the mother chews the food before giving the baby the food. When the mother chews it, anything that's there that shouldn't be there is going to be taken out, and everything is made soft and easy to digest and easy for the palate. Similarly, when we're presenting things to the people, we should do so and present it in the right way. Okay, there should be a goal behind what we're trying to convey to the people. At the end of the day, it's not just about the majlis. The majlis is a means towards a greater end. What is that greater end? For individuals to adopt a path of servitude in their lives and to attain perfection by becoming close to Allah. Now, how can we be part of that? We have to, for ourselves, we have to be very clear that I, in doing this zikr musibat, I'm not inviting the people to myself. Right? That's not the goal of this. I'm not inviting them just to cry. I'm inviting them to a higher truth. Right? This is my goal that I'm trying to, in doing what I'm doing. Now, one of the aspects of this is calling people to ilm. Right? Because when the way to attain those higher levels is through knowledge and by acting, learning and then acting upon that knowledge. And also ulama as well too. People like, you know, my teachers, people like the great ulama, we need to invite people to the ulama. How do we do that? One of the ways is by referencing ulama in our speeches and saying, ulama tell us this, or this alim says this in this book. Not just going directly for it and saying, okay, this is what this says. One time I can look up the hadith directly, okay, that has some value. Another time I can say that Shaheed Mutahhari uses this hadith. Now that has a lot more value because again, it's been chewed, it's been sort of filtered through the filter of an alim. Making use of stories of ulama as well too. For example, Allama Tabatabai Rahmatullahi Alayhi, most of us know him as a mufassir of the Qur'an. Most of us know him as a spiritual master. But he was also somebody who had deep love of Ahlul Bayt and Imam Hussein alayhi salam. And when he would be invited to majalis, he would accept the invitation. Put aside all of his work and he would go and then he would cry and shed tears to the point where his body was seen shaken. He was shaking when he was crying. Now if you mention this in your speech, then people will start to see ulama and that whole ilm and therefore the path towards perfection in a different light as well too. And the final point is, this doesn't mean that it should be boring, right? Trying to be creative is also a very good thing as well too. Trying to be innovative is a good thing, but not to sacrifice this opportunity to educate. Okay, next slide please. Okay, I realize that I think I've been sort of elaborating a little bit too much on the points, and maybe we're running out of time. I'll try to go fast and just mention a few more points, inshallah. We'll skip this one. And this one as well too. Okay, just a couple of points about the culture of majalis. Alhamdulillah that we have so many majalis and so many speakers. I was amazed to see this list of speakers. I was like, wow, subhanAllah, this is amazing that this city is blessed with so many individuals who are willing and able to, you know, recount the tragedy of Karbala to the people. But when it comes to this culture of majalis, we have to use the opportunity to guide people as to what's right and what's wrong. Because after all, people will, when they see something that's good, okay, they'll flock to it, they want to do the same thing, but they need guidance as to how to make it perfect, how to perfect that which is already good. So one of the points that we need to encourage people to do is to attend for the sake of Allah, not for the sake of people. Okay, to put on majalis for the sake of Allah, not for the sake of people. This is very important because sometimes it becomes a thing of like, okay, well, she came to my majlis, therefore I have to go to her majlis, or I did one last year, as Maulana mentioned, they have to do one this way, people are going to expect me to do it. No, it's the occasion of, you know, Hazrat Abbas, I have to do it, otherwise Hazrat Abbas is going to be upset with me, whatever it is. This should not be the approach. Okay, look at this quote from Imam Hussein alayhi salam. This is in one of his speeches. It's reported that he said, when he's talking to the scholars among the elite scholars of the time and the sons of the companions, he says that in response to the tyranny and injustice, you didn't give up any wealth to combat it, you didn't put your lives in danger, and you didn't oppose any of your family members for the sake of God. This was while you saw the covenants of God being violated, yet you did not care. Wow, when it came to family agreements and pacts, you were concerned. You see, within the message of Imam Hussein, we see this concept of preferring family pacts over the pacts of God. Right? This is a theme that we can expand upon in our speeches. Okay, next slide, please. Okay, next slide. All right, another point about encouraging the positive culture of majalis has to do with not letting this be a means of flaunting my wealth or flaunting my status and trying to impress people with my house or with the food that I give or the clothes that I wear or anything else like that. Where do we get this from? Again, from Imam Hussein. In that same speech, it's quoted, he says that truly you know, it's in the maqam of dua, oh Allah, truly you know that this was never about competing for power nor seeking material advantage. Rather, it was so that we could display the teachings of your religion and cause justice to reign in your land. Now, those who are holding majalis need to ask themselves, can they say the same thing or not? That is it truly for displaying the religion of Allah and causing justice to reign? Or, na'udhu billah, is it for competing or for seeking material advantage or those sorts of things? Okay. Next slide, please. Okay, the final points is just a reminder for myself, for first and foremost, and all of you, some points for somebody who is a zakir. Okay, the importance of emulation for ourselves. If we really want to be successful in conveying the message, then we ourselves have to be those who emulate the cause of Imam Hussein and Islam. We have to become Husseini, we have to become Ashura'i ourselves. The famous hadith of Imam Sadiq, كُونُوا دُعَاتًا لِلنَّاسِ بِغَيْرِ أَلْسِنَتِكُمْ, be those who call to the way, of our way, without your tongues. Let them see from you those good things, the watchfulness, the ibadah, the striving, because that is a form of invitation. Next slide, please. Now, what does that mean? One of the aspects of this is leading a balanced life. We need to show people what it means to lead a balanced life. Even during this period where we're busy, it shouldn't be the case that this occupation prevents us from attending to our responsibilities. So for example, if this becomes a cause of our ignoring our family during this time, then that wouldn't be right. Now of course, it might be the case that we're busy with something, we can't give the same level of attention that we normally can. But that shouldn't mean that we neglect those duties that are God-given. Right? We shouldn't neglect our other duties as well too. Duties of leading a balanced life when it comes to our own worship, when it comes to our own ability. Sometimes when we always are speaking and we never listen, then after all, our ears have a haq as well too. If we don't listen, then we might be benefiting others, but we're not benefiting from the experience ourselves. So very important that we have a balanced life and we encourage others to have a balanced life as well. Part of having a balanced life means that even during these 2 months of Muharram, we have to have a balanced life. Now this is important. If it's the case that the culture that's being created is one that every day people are attending majalis during the 2 months, and not just one majlis, but multiple majalis a day, then we can definitely say that this is creating an imbalance in people's lives. This is not positive. If it's the case, somebody told me that like from during these 2 months, from the time I get home from work till evening, I never see my family because the guys take one car and the girls take one car and then we just go to different houses, day in, day out, for 2 months. Well, that's not a positive sort of thing. That's not the way it's supposed to be. If it's the case for 2 months, the only thing I do is cry, but I don't have any moment of joy, that's not correct either. Now, I'm not saying, don't get me wrong, don't think I'm some controversial sort of modern type of reformer, as Maulana was saying, right? I'm not saying that during the 12 days we should be like laughing or something like that. But at the end of the day, after all, we are human beings. Our soul needs to cry, also needs to laugh as well too. And if for 2 months we suppress that, then it's going to create negative psychological and spiritual repercussions. So it's important that we encourage having a balanced life. Also for a zakir or a zakira, it's important to always continue the search for knowledge. If Allah gifted me with the ability to speak well, gifted me with a good memory, and a good a passion in my voice, well that becomes a test for me. A test for me to see how I can employ this in the way of Allah. Not that I just settle with these gifts and say, okay, now I'm set, and now I just use these and I'm done. No, I also have to achieve perfection And I also have to get closer to Allah, just like those that I'm trying to preach to as well. Therefore, it's important. One of the things that that all of us need to be doing is to seek knowledge at all times and to be seeking knowledge.
I'm not sure the mosque. I think it's the mosque which is doing
it. Okay. All right. So, it's fine. I got it. Okay. And so, one thing that I would advise is that as part of researching and studying, definitely there'll be times when questions come up. Like, you know, because you're studying Islam, right? The questions come, so make sure that we should all be in touch with ulama who can help us and guide us. Alhamdulillah, the city is blessed with ulama like the ones that previously gave speeches. You can be in touch with them, inshallah, and ask them questions. Make sure that we're conveying the right information, even for ourselves as well. Okay, last slide is the importance of ikhlas. This is just a reminder again for all of us, including myself, that we need to say what needs to be said, not necessarily what needs to be heard. Again, from Imam Hussein al-Islam. He's speaking to those people who were refusing to join him, even though they knew better. They should have known better. He says that you handed over the weak over to the tyrants to be their slaves, and the tyrants to act as they please. You appoint speakers from the pulpit in the cities to spread their message. Right? They used to have state speakers at that time who would just sponsor that type of Islam. We're not trying to we don't have to keep tuned to anybody else's agenda. The agenda that we have is the agenda of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam. If I say this, and maybe the host might take offense because maybe in some way it applies to them, maybe it has to do with hijab, maybe it has to do with halal or haram wealth, whatever it is, that's okay. Okay, of course I have to say it in the right way. If they don't invite me again, that's okay as well. After all, what am I doing? Am I doing it just to get invited again? No, I'm doing it for the sake of Allah, right? Even sometimes we might realize that, okay, you know what, this isn't something that I need to accept because it's going to throw me out of balance. Or if I have this right here, this is creating too much pressure for people to attend too many gatherings. Or there's somebody else better who can attend, let me invite them as well too. This issue of ikhlas, this could be a whole topic itself for a seminar, how ikhlas for zakirin and zakirat. But I thought we would suffice with this quote from Imam Hussein al-Islam. With that, I'd like to apologize for going a little bit over time. There were some points that I felt that were important to convey. I pray that Allah accepts all the efforts of those who put on this conference and attended. Wa sallallahu ala Muhammad wa ala alihi wa sahbihi.
Okay, and we're going to conclude with our Q&A session. So are there any questions for Sheikh Salim? Or the questions will be translated into English, just so you know, and he will be answering in English as well. So please send your questions forward, if there are any. It's a wonderful opportunity. Brother's side, sister's youth. Is there a question? Okay. You're free to write them on papers and send them up and just ask anonymously if you're too shy to. Okay. Can I bring you the mic?
Sure. Thanks. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Oftentimes, I feel like there's a bit of a generational gap between our parents and, their generation, our generation, and I guess it comes back down to the method of, not just the method of delivery, but I guess the content as well, and what that generation holds dear and what they value, and in comparison to what we hold dear and what we value. And oftentimes it becomes a conflict. And it kind of, on a personal level, it's something that bothers me. I'm not really sure how we could overcome such a problem, I guess, because I kind of see it personally in the community time to time. And I think it's something that's important that should be tackled. So how would you suggest that we overcome, I guess, generational issues? I guess specifically in terms of majalis.
Okay, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So that's a very good question, and it is something that is definitely an issue. One of the suggestions is what I made in the presentation, which is this idea that, okay, as the person who is invited to speak, they can be advised regarding this, and also those of you who are speaking, you can yourselves adopt this approach of making sure that the content that is presented somehow does appeal to the intellect. And that's one sort of big distinction between speeches that are appropriate for the next this generation versus those. I mean, and it means that it can't just be something which is polemical. It can't just be something which is emotional. It also has to have some rational appeal as well, too. Another thing that's important is that those who are presenting, they should, in some way or form, make sure that they do present some points that are relevant, that talk about issues that people are really facing. Now, as for what should be said about those issues, as Maulana was saying, like, not to be like aggressive, not to be controversial in that regard. Just presenting the standard sort of Islamic opinion on those issues is sufficient. But even that itself sometimes is lacking. Sometimes the discussion is about something like way, kind of like out there, just not really applicable to really anything that most people are facing. So choosing the right topic is also very important as well, too. Another thing is to maybe even change the format as well, too, not just let it be a traditional sort of program. Like, think about innovative ways of having more participation, of having question and answer, of doing things in a way that maybe having even like poetry, spoken word, other things that would make it something more appropriate and appealing to this next generation.
Is that okay? Do you have a follow-up? It's okay? Okay, thank you very much. Any other questions? Okay, Sister Nosheen?
Assalamu alaikum. Okay, so my question was that year after year, as Muharram comes and goes, speaking for myself first and also anyone who this applies to, we often feel that loss of spark that comes in Muharram. As we go through Muharram, the spark is alive, but then once Muharram finishes, and especially for the youth speakers, and even the elder ones, that spark kind of goes away. And as we said, the importance of emulating it in our actions, that kind of goes away as well. How do we keep that alive? It's a very hard thing to do, and it may seem like a simple question, but it's very difficult to keep that spark alive, the spark of Al-Adari and like the importance of it throughout the year. How do we continue to do that? Thank you.
It's a very good question. The spark that we feel, that buzz that we get, it's really strange. Like, it's when we cry for Imam Hussein, it's a very sad thing. But if you go and look at the state of your heart after you cried for Imam Hussein, you'll see that there's a lot of happiness in your heart. And it's like this odd sort of thing. Now, what is going on here? How is it that crying over something sad makes us happy, that we have that spiritual buzz? It has to do with the fact that remembering Imam Hussein is a form of remembering Allah. And the dhikr of Allah is that which brings peace and tranquility to the hearts. And so what we're after is, what we need to be trying to do is to pursue this very simple but very profound and very important goal, which is how do we remember Allah even beyond Muharram? And the way to remember Allah beyond Muharram is to do so in a practical way with our actions. Meaning that if we have committed ourselves to doing our responsibility in our actions, we know what our responsibility is. We know what the wajibat are, we know what the muharramat are, we know what it is that Allah wants of us. And we put that into practice, and we ensure that we are doing so, and we build upon that, and we are consistent in doing so, then that will be a practical form of dhikr of Allah, and that will be something that will bring about this wonderful feeling of remembrance of Allah, even outside of Muharram as well, too. Our issue is that, it's kind of like when I grew up, I used to have family members, right, where they would always keep the music on there in the car outside of Muharram. But then when it came down to Muharram, okay, it's the 12 days of Muharram, no music during this time. Okay, well then after Muharram, then the music would go on again, right? So our problem is exactly that. If we just kept the music off even after, then we'd see that dhikr of Allah would be possible to maintain even afterwards as well.
Sheikh Salim, we actually have a call from, I believe it's the States, I'm not sure, but it's a long distance call. I'm just going to put it on speaker and then we can. Hello, assalamu alaikum. Go ahead with your question, please.
Okay, my name is Sayyid Hassan and I'm calling from North Carolina. Thank you for the very nice presentation, Maulana. And I just have a quick question from you. We have been celebrating Muharram, commemorating Muharram and giving out the message of Imam Hassan alayhi salam. I would like you to point out for, especially for our young, when we want to invite people from other faiths into our speeches to attend Muharram program, what would be some of the basic ideas which we would like to propagate, which help them in support of Imam Hussein's message, and which should also appeal to them that this is the right religion. Thank you.
Thank you for your question, Sheikh Salim.
Thank you for the question. I guess there's one time when you can have an event which is geared towards inviting people of other faiths or let's say non-Shias, other Muslims to and invite them to that event, like a Hussein Day type of thing, and then you kind of talk about Imam Hussein. That's one time type of event that you can have. What I was speaking about in the majlis, actually, in the presentation, was that even in your majalis that you have, it should be the case that anybody could walk in and they wouldn't feel like there's something offensive taking place. So whatever it is that you normally would say, just say exactly the same things, because after all, it's all coming from, you know, the divine source. It's all, inshallah, a reflection of the light of Allah, and it's something that will be attractive to whoever has a fitrah. But if you do want to have a special event where you set it up and you invite people to Karbala, to Imam Hussein, then this is something which, first of all, I would really encourage that you take the advice of experts on this issue, not just come up with the Charles Dickens or the Mahatma Gandhi version of it and say, okay, let's have a seminar and talk about these type of things, right? Because it goes deeper than that. For example, there's a number of things that could be talked about, but we could talk about something that would help us identify Yazidi outlook towards life and the Yazids of our time, something along that aspect, if you want to talk about political things, right? Or we could talk about this concept of submission, talking about submission and the use of the aql, right? These are things that we get from Karbala as well too. The concept of ihqaq al-haq, the concept of drawing the line between truth and falsehood, that's something that could be talked about as well too. The position of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, if there's going to be Sunni Muslims there talking about the Ahlul Bayt from their own sources, that would be something that could be talked about as well too. These are just some ideas that come off the top of my head. But sometimes I should say that we tend to reduce the message to just be a message of peace or something like, let's just go and hand out flowers, right? And this becomes like all that there is about Karbala. Now, handing out flowers is not a bad thing. It can be a good thing. But if we want to present a balanced sort of perspective, then we should hand out the flowers. We should also talk about the injustice as well.
Thank you very much for that reply, Sheikh Salim. We do have another question here that's been translated from Urdu. The question is, according to the hadith, مَنْ عَرَفَهُ زَمَانَ آمَنَهُ, whoever recognizes their era, they have protected themselves. So the question is asking for elaboration. What is meant by recognizes and how do we protect ourselves and our masail and fazail ways to recognize our imam or our era? I hope I posed the question accurately. What is meant by recognizes and how do we protect ourselves and how do we use masail and fazail in ways to facilitate that?
Masail is like masail of
Yes.
I
Messiah. Okay, Messiah.
And
okay. Is that correct? Yeah? Okay.
It's a very good question. It requires a bit of thought.
You can take a minute. It's okay.
Let me process that in the background.
Sure, absolutely. Take your time.
Is there anything else in the meantime?
Is there anything else in the meantime? Shawma has another question. Yes.
Assalamu alaikum. We usually go, like, I'm not a zakir, I'm Suskwan, but we usually go to majalis and we see that people observe and they do things that they have been observing since their generations, and they have been following those rituals and cultural things in ways of mannat and niyaz and nazars. And they have no logic actually, but they have been observing it because their parents and grandparents were doing it since generations. Like for instance, like one of my friends told me that they have to, for Hazrat Abbas Hazri, cook parathas for about a certain number of kilograms every year, and like nobody wants to eat it, and how do I have to, because my mother-in-law was doing it since 10 years, and if I will not do it, I'll be cursed, and so, blah, blah, blah. And I told her, you know what, because we live here, there are no more people around you, you have to be in your home, so you can just do it, just make the number of parathas that you want for your family, and then you can go ahead, like, it's your niyat, and it's your marfat, and your khulus, that these I am my crumbs will see, but people get very, very sensitive about these issues, and it's very, very hard to tell them how to keep going with these issues. So can you please address, like, how can we move on with this thing?
Thank you for your question. It's a good question.
Okay.
Just an example. Like, you know,
Yeah, actually, two of the slides that we had to skip because of time reasons had to do with this issue of like the rituals, and since you brought it up now, at least I can mention a couple of points. When we go to the first of all, let's try to understand what are we trying to do. Okay, we're trying to commemorate the tragedy of Karbala. Okay, so question: how is it that the Ahlul Bayt commemorated the tragedy of Karbala? What did they used to do? Did they used to make paratha? Right? What did they do? Right? When we go to the seerah of the Ahlul Bayt, we see two actions that frequently we see narrated from what they used to do. One of them is that they used to cry. Another thing is that they used to have poetry recited for the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam. Okay? So these are two things that is our responsibility to carry on and to practice, within our times, in our own languages, whatever it may be. But we need to cry, we need to have poetry. Okay. Now beyond that, what about all the other things that we do? Is it the case that because the Ahlul Bayt, we don't have a report that the Ahlul Bayt did them, then we can't do them? No. That's not how we understand Islam. Islam isn't something where we have to find a hadith behind every specific action that we do. Rather, we look for principles from the Ahlul Bayt in Islam. The principle that they emphasize is that of grieving for what took place. It's very important that we grieve, and we grieve with others, and we invite people to grieve as well too. Okay, we make sure to keep this alive in the hearts of the people. Now, how we do that, will depend on the situations of the time. Whatever is appropriate in your culture, in your situation, as long as it's not contradictory to the laws of Islam, and it's not something which is contrary to the sha'an of what's being commemorated, it's okay to do. Okay, so, for example, the way that we, the rituals that we have regarding matam and nohas and majalis, whatever it is, like some of these things we do find specifically in the seerah of the Ahlul Bayt. Other things are something which are appropriate to the times, to our culture, and they are compatible with the message that's been trying to convey. These are good to do. Okay. Now, if there's something which is illogical, which doesn't have any basis, which isn't in the spirit of mourning, which doesn't have, which is even contradictory towards the spirit of Imam Hussein, that's something that shouldn't be observed. You know, so if it's something that is causing, like, stress for somebody, right? It's causing financial pressure where they can't otherwise manage the other responsibilities. If there's no, it's just being done purely out of a ritual, and there's no law from the marja, you know, from in the risala that says we have to cook this many paratha with this many kilograms of flour, then why are we doing it then? So I would encourage that approach of going based on principles. On the one hand, if we see something that somebody is doing and we don't understand it, not immediately criticize. But on the other hand, we need to educate people about this importance of going back to the principle. And if something is against the principle, then it needs to be left aside.
Thank you very much. We have a question from the brother's side.
It's not first clarification, it's not question from me. It's a translation of the question. I will try my best. The person has tried to write down the hadith, you know, we have from Imam, or the call of Imam. O Allah, give me the marifat of your hujjah. Right? It's a long one. Marifat of Allah, Rasul, and hujjah. And if I don't have this marifat, so I will be in zalala, ignorance. So after that it says, over here the meanings of marifat. What is the meaning of marifa first? Is the meaning of marifa is sufficient, then we should have a masaib, a fazail, and you know, the masaib of Imam Hussain alayhi salam or Aima alayhi salam. It's enough, or there is something more than that, the marifa in this hadith? That's the question.
So let me just summarize the question. Tell me if I got it right. Is in order to gain marifa of the Imam, is it enough to have fada'il and masaib? That's the question, right? And okay. Sure. So the answer is, straightforward, that fada'il and masaib are an important component in gaining that ma'rifah of the Imam. But just having that and having no follow-up isn't going to be sufficient. Right, that has to be a catalyst. It has to be a trigger for action and for more knowledge. So, for example, when we see like Imam Hussein alayhi salam, that famous hadith you all heard, that throughout the day of Karbala, as more and more tragedies came, we saw that his face was getting brighter and brighter. Right? Now, understanding, we see that's one of the fazail, that we talk about. That's something that we do in Musibat Imam Hussein. We cry over that as the day went along, his face got brighter and brighter. But now, that it's not just to be something to be talked about, something to be understood. How is it that somebody can be at that position where they feel Allah and they know and they see Allah so close to them that whatever takes place, right, it can't faze them, meaning they only get more and more certain about Allah the more difficulties that come their way. Most of us would just crumple at even a bit of that tragedy if we were to face it ourselves in our own lives. So that question should come up for ourselves, and when we see these things, it should spur us to become like Imam Hussein by taking the path of Imam Hussein, which is the path of Ubudiyah. So if we want to know what the answer is, if we want to gain the ma'rifah of the Imam, the ma'rifah of the Imam can be attained through Ubudiyah. And that's why if you look at that dua, it says, Allahumma arifni nafsak. First I start with Allah, and all these masaib and fadal encourage me to do that. That, O Allah, I want to gain ma'rifah of you, I want to know you. Because when I know you, then I will worship you. And when I worship you, I will know you even better. And that, with that type of knowledge, then I can turn to understand who the Prophet was in a different way than previously I was understanding. And I can understand the hujjah in a different way that I was understanding before. The dua is speaking to, it's one of those duas which truly is amazing, because you can understand it at various different levels and different levels of ma'rifah. But in a very simple way, we have to understand that the ma'rifah, those things that we gain through fadal and masab, should take us to want to know the ma'rifah of Allah, and then take this journey until we know the Imam of our time.
There's one more question, and then after this we'll have time for one more question from Sister Shamama. This question is regarding, it's actually referencing Maulana Rizvi's speech, where he had touched upon the use of poetry and how much leeway the poets have to actually use their imagination in conjunction with their talent or skill when it comes to the Zikr of Karbala. So can you elaborate on that in terms of how much leeway they do have with their imagination when it comes to poetry?
Whether somebody is doing poetry or whether they're just recounting the musibat, when we talk about, you know, making the musibat mustanad, mean that we look at the sources, it doesn't mean that we can't be creative. Okay, this is very important. First, we need to understand what's been written in history, and we have to understand that well. Okay, like looking at multiple sources, preferably multiple reputable sources, right? Now, given what took place, understanding the spirit behind what took place, now we can use our creative skills to recount what took place. Okay, in a way that is not going to be contradictory to what took place. We can't talk about supernatural things taking place when there's no sort of basis for that. Just talk, okay, and this is when, for example, you know, this person came. Came from the dead and they joined the event. Well, you know, where is that in the in any history book, right? We can say, however, that if Sayyida Fatima were to be there, what would she say if she saw this, right? There's two different things there. But that's compatible. This one's not compatible. When I say that she came, I mean, you know, where did that come from, right? But oh, if she were to say there, maybe she would have said this thing right here. You know, that's something which is perfectly okay. So. Making sure that it has to be something which is credible given the context, and we have to be able to separate from that which is recorded in history and that which is zaban-e-hal, right? Where we're saying that perhaps this is what this person would have said at that point, or if this were like this, then this would have been the case there. So the poet or the zakir should make that clear for the people as well too. And sometimes you can say the most wonderful things that, in a very creative sort of way, that is very appropriate for that thing, and makes people cry without ever crossing over those lines. And people actually respect that as well too, because they see that you're taking a lot of effort to make sure that you're conveying to the best of your ability actually what took place, but with a creative sort of way.
We did have another question from a sister in North Carolina who was asking via phone. The question is the goal of Azadari just to cry and do matam, or is it to propagate the cause or reason of why Imam Hussein sacrificed his life? So I think that topic has been covered throughout with each speaker. So instead of getting into that once again, because we're pressed for time, I think a good idea would be to maybe email the presentation, the PowerPoint presentation, to the sister. All of that is covered in that wonderful presentation, and I don't think that Sheikh Salim would mind passing that on to her. So if we could maybe do that. Last question is from Sister Shamama, and then we will wrap up, inshallah.
Assalamu alaikum, everyone. My question is about creating a positive culture around majalis and how we can incorporate that into having a balanced life during the months of Muharram as well, but also having that spark that we talked about. So my question is, what are some practical tips for implementing a positive culture? Because you talked about the negative culture that's sometimes around majalis. So what are some ways instead to transform that into a positive culture?
Well, I think that, you know, obviously those of you who are attending these majalis, you're part of them, you're speaking at them, you would be in the best position to figure out how to take some of these principles and put them into practice, or encourage others to put them into practice. So I'm not gonna. I don't want to speak about the details of like, okay, take this step, take this, or offer suggestions in that regard. I just want to emphasize those principles again. Okay, like there's a principle of keeping things simple. Now, how is it that we're going to convey that to people? You know, I give you a quote of Imam Hussein if you want to use that in your speeches. If you want to tell people, remind them, or before you accept an invitation, you actually make a condition that, oh, I'm only going to accept if you have like X number of dishes. If you go beyond like, you know, two or three, or if you have like two different types of meat, that I'm not going to accept. Whatever. Sometimes we have to take drastic measures because it goes really overboard in some cases, right? Or just talking to people frankly, because most people we know like there's so and so much they give this type of food, or they have this type of gathering. Talking to them and just saying this is not right and conveying the message that way. Another principle we talked about is that of having the majalis for sincere purposes and attending for the right reason, not just because they came to my majlis, that type of thing. So addressing that, however it is that you can address that, and when it comes to the balance thing. Trying to encourage people to have the right number of majalis that they attend and the right number that they hold. Again, it shouldn't be the case that people are forced to go from every night, every evening, multiple hours, and this is all they do for an extended period of time. This is just, it can't be the case. Imagine how many things that we're prevented from doing during this time. How can we seek knowledge if that's the only thing that we're doing? There's one type of knowledge we gain from majalis, but there's other types of knowledge that we need to gain when we take our own effort, we go to classes. If you look at the Ahlul Sunnah, and I'm not saying that we just do everything what they do, or that somehow I'm enamored by what they do, but there's some things that we can learn from them. You look at their centers are used as a source of learning so much more than our centers are. They have Quran classes, they have classes about the seerah of the Prophet, they have classes on prayer. If you just look at a typical busy Sunni masjid, they have so many more educational programs than our centers do. Why is that the case? Is it a deliberate attempt on our part to not have that? No. It's the fact that we have a limited amount of programming, and if we just fill up all that programming with majalis, then there's no room for the educational programs. Okay, so there has to be some sort of balance. Now, how that can take place when you have so many mu'mineen and everyone wanting to have a majlis at their home, I don't know. Okay, I really don't know, have the answer for that. But these are some principles. Inshallah, it's up to you to figure out how it is that you can, if you accept them, to put them into practice.